This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. As we begin, my understanding for this session was to speak not so much about Lewis's specific arguments, but more about his apologetic approach. And I would like to do that. Also, C.S. Lewis, as many of you know, probably his best books are his literary critical books. He taught medieval and Renaissance literature at Oxford and later at Cambridge. And in one essay he wrote called The Genesis of a Medieval Book, is that the medievalists did not tell new stories. They embellished old stories. So I would like to engage in some bit of embellishment also, take a concept from Lewis and maybe show you some practical application that I've found is helpful, and maybe that will generate your own thinking as you apply what he tried to do to your own context. But before I actually get into C.S. Lewis, I hate to confess this, but it's true. I'm concerned about something more than just C.S. Lewis here. And I'll see if I can put it in context. Then we'll pray and we'll get going. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and we were poor. I remember watching the children at the elementary school that I attended go to the cafeteria to eat lunch, and I always wanted to eat lunch at the cafeteria, but it cost 31 cents, and for our family that was prohibitive. But I remember the day that my mother handed me, to my surprise, 31 cents so I could eat in the cafeteria. But now, as excited as I was to have this opportunity, I was also nervous because I was completely unaware of the sociological protocols of cafeteria life for a 9-year-old child. So I watched with intensity the girl in front of me, and I did everything she did so I wouldn't do something foolish and the other students laugh at me. She paid the cafeteria cashier. I did the same thing. She grabbed her fiberglass tray. I did the same thing. She grabbed her knife, fork, and spoon. I did exactly as she did. She took that tray to that chrome roll bar counter. Do you guys remember those sorts of things? And I started sliding my tray across it, and the girl in front of me came to the first item, and it was string beans. I hated string beans. I don't know that I like them any better now. And the girl said to the cafeteria lady, do you remember the cafeteria lady? She was kind of heavy set, and she had white hair and a hairnet and a white outfit with an apron with smudge marks on it. She actually worked in every cafeteria of every elementary school across the world. The ubiquitous cafeteria lady. The girl said, "I'll have a small portion of those, please." I'd never heard the word portion before in my life. And I watched as the cafeteria lady turned behind her, grabbed a small bowl, a big spoon with holes in it so the juices could go through, dug deep into a pot, and put 3 string beans in the bowl and handed it to the girl. I said to the cafeteria lady, "I'll have a small portion of those too, please." And she did the same thing for me. I went on down the line. I got different things on my tray. I came to the end of the line. Remember what was at the end of those lines? The desserts. And I looked at what I thought were the most economically cut pieces of chocolate cake I'd ever seen in my life. And I wondered if this word might have other applications. So I said to the cafeteria lady, "I'll have a large portion of that, please." And she cut me the biggest piece of chocolate cake I had ever seen in my whole life. And I thought to myself, that's a good word. Remember that word. Well, the psalmist uses it in Psalm 73. Where he says, "Whom have I in heaven but thee, and besides thee I desire nothing on earth. My heart and my flesh may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." And frankly, more than C.S. Lewis, I want a larger portion of God. And I'm hoping that in this session, while Lewis may be a means for us, and a good means, that the end will be we will leave here refreshed in our walk with God. Okay? So let's pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for the great privilege that we have of being recipients of your goodness and grace to us in Christ, that we have received the forgiveness of sins, which allows us to pick ourselves up from our failures and face life afresh. We thank you for the love of God that encourages us and motivates us to grow. And we thank you also, Father, for the grace of God that has fallen upon us, not only as a privilege, but as a responsibility that we might tell others about your Son. I pray, Father, in that process, that you would give us wisdom, that you would give us nimbleness of mind, that you would give us humility, and that you would fill us with your Holy Spirit. I pray for each participant in this seminar that we would learn wonderful things from Lewis. And yet ultimately, Father, it's you we want, more of you. And I pray that we would get a larger portion of you this session. And we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Richard Pertile once tried to describe why Lewis was so successful as an apologist, as a popular Christian apologist. And he recognized there were several things. First, his intellectual capacities. Pertile notes that Lewis understood concepts well enough to translate them into the vernacular. And Lewis was intentional about this. How could you put cookies on the lower shelf so that people could get to them? He also sought to listen and understand what critics were saying. Lewis was the president of the Oxford Socratic Club. And in Oxford, there would be a Christian who would read a paper and non-Christians would respond to it. The next week, a non-Christian would read a paper and Christians would respond to it. And so it went. When he left the Oxford Socratic Club to go to Cambridge as a professor, Basil Mitchell became the president of the Oxford Socratic Club, the eminent Oxford philosopher. And Mitchell, in one of his books called Faith and Criticism, I think shares with us some important ways where we might model what Lewis did as he sought to listen and understand what his critics were saying. In Faith and Criticism, he said the person of faith needs the critic. If we don't listen to the critic, we run into the temptation of painting a thus saith the Lord across our own opinions. We need these challenges so we can prune what might be our own prejudices from what might be central to faith. But also the critic, who doesn't know everything, needs to recognize that his positions are often faith positions as well. So Mitchell says that one thing that we need to do is listen. And listening requires that we give others veto power over our impressions of them. If somebody says something to me and I react immediately to what I think they're saying, we may be talking like this because I may have missed them completely. If it's a technical area, I might say back to them, let me see if I've got you right. Is this what you meant? And if they say, oh no, that's not what I meant at all, now I'm glad I didn't respond to what I thought they said. Could you give it to me again? Please be patient with me. I don't often get it right. They give it to me again, and I say, let me see if I've got you right again. I say it back to them, giving them veto power over my understanding of what they've suggested. Finally, I get to the place where we're on the same page, and oftentimes I find there's not much conflict. They may just be articulating something different. I mean, something, the same thing, but from a different angle. Or it might be that we do disagree, and I say, well, I understand that you have considered A, B, and C, but it doesn't seem to me that you have considered X, Y, and Z. And they may be delighted then to hear this new information, and they put that in their system, and they come out with a similar conclusion. Or they might say, no, I did consider X, Y, and Z, but it seems to me you haven't considered L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. And I grow in that kind of encounter. And Lewis was not afraid to listen to what others said and make sure he got them right. Also, as an adult convert to Christianity, Pertile recognizes that he remembered the objections he had to overcome in order to believe. It was relatively fresh in his own mind. So consequently, because he knew that he struggled, he was sympathetic or empathetic towards the struggles of others in the process of faith. He also believed that Christianity, and by the way, because he was empathetic, he was not condescending. You don't get condescension in Lewis. He may be firm, he may be confident, but he's not condescending, or belittling, or demeaning. He believed that Christianity was reasonable also, more reasonable than other points of view. He once wrote, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. I hear a little bit of an echo of G.K. Chesterton coming through at that point. Lewis was encouraged by Chesterton's style of apologetics. And Chesterton said, I don't believe in Christianity because one or two things prove it. I believe in Christianity because everything seems to suggest its proof. And consequently, as a result, he worked on a composite approach and is arguing not just a single, he wasn't firing on a single piston. Pertil also says that Lewis had imaginative capacities, his power to create metaphors. This is something I want to talk about in more detail later. Pertil wrote this, "In his fiction, we often find a real argument transposed into the fictional setting. Sometimes it's less pretentious, but also in some ways more powerful in its delivery," and we'll talk about that later. Pertil also notes that Lewis had moral capacities. There was a humility about him. Oftentimes apologists can drift away from humility. We have answers, you see. We want to give those answers. And it can be dangerous ground. We'll talk more about the humility in Lewis later. And also that he was not so concerned about his reputation as he was concerned about the truths he sought to explain. And lastly, under moral capacities, he had an enthusiastic love for so many things. He could enter a conversation where people were at rather than having to meet people on his turf. So the broader the reading, the broader the understanding. As a matter of fact, this is an interesting thing. He wrote about 72 titles. I think there were 56 during his life. He wrote more after he died than any other person, I think. Actually, after his death, there were a lot of essays that he wrote in journals and so on that were gathered and put together under single cover. And there are, I think, six volumes of his correspondence and so on. But there are 72 titles. But one book particularly is called English Literature in the 16th Century Excluding Drama. It took him 14 years to write that book, and he wrote it for the Oxford History of English Literature. He called it his O Hell volume, Oxford History English Literature. To write that book, he read every book written in English in the 16th century. He read every book translated into English in the 16th century in its original, most of them were written in Latin, and in its translation so that he could make the comparison. It's a remarkable book. Not only that, it was the century of the Reformation. He's the only person I know of who read both sides of the Reformation thoroughly and completely. And you should read some of his Irenic judgments. It's very interesting. I think it would be good for us. But it shows the breadth of his learning, and it shows, then, too, his capacity to enter a conversation on another person's turf. I think that's important. Anyway, now as we begin to work towards our outline that you have in your book, I think Lewis was a person who, in his apologetic approach, was able to appeal to the whole person. George MacDonald, who is an author who influenced C.S. Lewis, in a novel he wrote called Annals of a Quiet Neighborhood, had one character in that novel say, "We do not have souls." He said, "We are souls." Excuse me. Yeah, we do not have souls. We are souls. We have bodies. If you tell a child he has a soul, he thinks he could lose it, like he could lose his coat or his keys. So that when he dies, he thinks he goes to the grave and his soul goes off to heaven. But tell the child he is a soul, and that when he dies, he goes to heaven and he leaves his body behind like we leave clipped hair behind on the barbershop floor. That's interesting. But if we are souls, what makes up the soul? You are all familiar with the raging debates and so on. It's complex. I don't know that I know exactly. But traditionally, we would say that the soul includes a mind, emotion, and will. Apologists tend towards the academic side of things. And in an academic environment, I hate to tell you this, but I think of the mind, the emotion, and the will, the reason is probably the weakest part of us. Let me see if I can make my case. If I make a bad choice volitionally, does my reason kick in and say, "Boy, Jerry, that was a stupid choice. You follow along that track, and you're going to hurt yourself, and you're going to hurt others"? No. Usually my reason is marshaled by my will to make all kinds of excuses for the bad choice. Paul said we suppress truth in our unrighteousness. Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics said vice is unconscious of itself. G.K. Chesterton says vice demands a sort of virginity as it justifies itself. And not only that, C.S. Lewis said in one of his literary critical works, A Preface to Paradise Lost, continued disobedience to conscience makes conscience blind. He had grown up in Wheaton. Wheaton is a predominantly Christian community. Lots of church on every corner, lots of Christians. This guy had gone to a Christian school. He had become an atheist. And my kids were concerned about him. Their friends were concerned about him. They said, Dad, can we bring him by? As I talked with Tim, I discovered that he was a very bright young man. I was impressed. But as I talked with him, though he reasoned fairly well, there were places where I saw just direct contradiction in his reasoning. And after discussing with him for about 45 minutes, maybe an hour, I said, Tim, I'm coming to the conclusion that I don't think it's reason that's holding you to your atheist position. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you're really smart, but you're making some mistakes in your reasoning that are below your capacity. I think you're driven by something else. He said, what would you say? I said, I think maybe you're emotionally wounded or something. He said, what do you mean? He was very curious about this. I said, well, I don't have a clue. I'm not a prophet, but let me just venture a guess. Maybe somebody in your life, who knows, maybe your father has lived a life like he was a Christian in the public eye, but at home maybe he was abusive and hurtful to you, and you saw hypocrisy, and what you're really responding to is an emotional reaction to a man who said he was a Christian who didn't live consistently at home. He went like this. How'd you know? I said, tell me your story. His father was a leader in one of the churches. He would preach. He was an elder on his board. And at home, he would beat his wife and beat his children and talk to them in foul ways. And I said, if I grew up in that environment with you, I'm sure I would have similar struggles that you have. And it doesn't seem to me that your position is unreasonable given your condition and given the models that you've seen. But I also said to him, if we judged any segment of society by its worst examples, who could stand? And is this fair for you to project this on Christ himself? And we started talking and we engaged in discussion, but we first talked about the emotional issues, appealing to the whole man. This was a concern of Lewis's also. And I'll develop this a little bit further later. But the interesting thing is Tim, I can say now after about 5 or 6 years, has moved from atheism to agnosticism, has left behind materialism, and is now at least a theist. He's making some move. He's also been able to talk to his father and resolve some of the tensions in their relationship. I think it would be the father's responsibility to initiate that, but Tim was courageous and initiated that kind of conversation. Anyway, second thing is I would suggest to you that Lewis is concerned about reality. It was Anthony Trollope in his novel Barchester Towers who said that only the preacher can compel people to sit still and be tortured. I know this is not true. I think we teachers do a far better job of it because we hold grades over students' heads, you see, and we can torture much better. But the question is, how do you engage in any kind of persuasive rhetoric without being manipulative? And all of us apologists should be concerned about this. And I believe that Lewis's approach was to get shoulder to shoulder with a person and describe some bit of reality. And if he could describe it well, he wasn't making the person dependent upon him. He was creating in the person a fascination, an awe, a curiosity in the thing itself. So if he moves away, if he's described it well, this person still remains connected. If all reality seen accurately speaks in some way of the glory of God, at least the scriptures tell us that. The heavens declare the glory of God. The earth showeth his handiwork. There's an integration of faith in our learning at this point. In his essay, The English Syllabus, a lecture that he delivered at Oxford University in the 1930s to the English faculty, Lewis said this, "We have fulfilled our whole duty to you if we help you see some given tract of reality. And if we help you see it well, we think you'll be fascinated and you'll continue to tease these things out." How many of you are familiar with Terry Eagleton's works, the literary critical theorist, okay, Marxist theorist? Interesting guy. Taught at Cambridge, later at Oxford, now he teaches at Manchester. He was a leading Marxist literary critical theorist, grew up Roman Catholic. He rejected the Catholic faith, became maybe not quite an atheist, but probably a radical agnostic. Over the years, and by the way, his Marxism was not a Stalinistic Marxism. It was a concern for the poor that found comfort in a Marxist approach to life to alleviate the burdens of the poor and so on. And he would deconstruct literature in the way you would expect a Marxist critic to do it. He got back into the Catholic Church through liberation theology. And if you know liberation theology and Marxism, you see where the segue works. And consequently, he's also returned to more traditional forms of Catholicism. He wrote a book recently called After Theory. Did any of you read this by any chance? I would suggest you pick it up. It came out, I think, 2003, 2004. Basically, he's saying postmodernism is over. Now, I don't know if this is going to catch the winds of imagination. When Derrida delivered his speech on difference in Toronto in 1968, how many papers were read at academic meetings? But why was it that when he raised those sails, the winds of the imagination caught the sails and went out of the harbor, and we've got all the discussion that we call postmodernism today? I don't know why. I don't think that postmodernism started with Derrida. I think it was a match in a tinderbox of many contributing factors twined together to form this movement. But basically, Eagleton is saying that postmodernism is over. Anybody who reads Lewis shouldn't be surprised. Lewis, when he wrote The Discarded Image on the medieval worldview, he basically said the medieval worldview, as glorious as it was going to be a discarded image. All worldviews will be discarded images. All. Even our present Christian worldview. Because the God we seek to describe by it is bigger than anything we presently conceive about him. And so it always has to be up for modification. If it's not so, then we would be still using a first century Christian worldview. But we pass through Nicaea. We pass through Chalcedon. And our view keeps getting bigger and bigger to accommodate itself to a big God. Okay, so you read Lewis and he says all worldviews will be discarded worldviews. So why not believe that postmodernism will eventually have the death knell sounded for it? And so, in fact, that's what Eagleton is saying. He appreciates the postmodernist warning to examine our assumptions. And we should appreciate that too. Lest we start painting thus saith the Lord across our own opinions. But Eagleton's call, interestingly enough, in the post-postmodern world, is a call to objectivity of text. And he says, but the only way we can get to the objectivity of text is by having safe dialectical communities where we could listen to the perspectives of others on the text. We're referencing our remarks to some sort of plumb line so we could correct the scoliosis of our thinking by the plumb line of the objective text. To have that safe dialectic community, he says we need to have love in place. Boy, oh boy, everything he's saying sounds to me an awful lot like the gospel. Or at least Jesus' statement, certainly in the upper room, to the disciples. Lewis himself had said, I want to get to reality. In my own eyes, he says at the end of the Experiment and Criticism, in the epilogue of the Experiment and Criticism, my own eyes are not enough for me. I would see what others have seen. I would read what they have written. Even what they have seen is not enough for me. I would read what they've imagined. Even what they've imagined is not enough for me. I regret that the brutes cannot write books. Gladly would I see how the world presents itself to the eye of a mouse or a bee, or how it comes charged to the olfactory sense of a dog. Wow, that's great. We Christians, if we're listening to where the literary critical community is going anyway, should be able to jump in and say, you know, we've got some stuff like that. Right here in the gospel, Jesus was saying the same sort of thing. Problem is, oftentimes, the world's not listening to us because our communities are so screwed up. We don't have love in place. We're not dialectically safe. We can't listen to another person who disagrees with us without rejecting them with some sort of dismissive ad hominem. God help us. God help us to get our lives in sync with the plumb line of text so there will be some authority in what we begin to say. Anyway, I think Eagleton is similar to Lewis in calling us to reality. It is objective. Not only that, Lewis says, and I would suggest to you in reading all of Lewis over and over and over again, from his pre-Christian work even to his last work that he wrote before he died, the most dominant theme in Lewis is this: reality is iconoclastic. Reality is iconoclastic. Let me see if I can explain this. An iconoclast is a person who breaks idols. So I have an image of God. I have attended a sermon. I came here to the forum. I heard some interesting things. I heard Richard speak, or I heard Dallas Willard speak. And I came away and I said, wow, that shakes my world. And I have this new image and this new understanding, fresh, vibrant. It's thrilling to my soul. But if I hold on to that new image too tightly, it begins to compete against my having a growing understanding of God. So consequently, the image once helpful now becomes destructive to my growth. God in His mercy, the great iconoclast, always kicks out walls of temples I build for Him because He wants to give me more of Himself. I think as apologists, we need to communicate a vibrant and robust understanding of God. He's bigger than our thoughts about Him. Lewis writes in his autobiography, God cares nothing about temples built, but only about temples building. This isn't new with Lewis. He's stepping in an old tradition. It goes back to Augustine in the Confessions when he says, the house of my soul is too small, O Lord. Enlarge it that you might enter in. Or it goes back to Acts 7, Stephen's defense. Remember? He was charged with speaking against the temple. And Stephen says to the religious leaders of his day, you think you've got God contained in the box of the temple? Don't you remember, he argues, that God first appeared to our father Abraham in Mesopotamia? Hundreds of miles from where this temple is. And God appeared to Moses in a burning bush in the wilderness of Midian. And later appeared to him at Mount Sinai, hundreds of miles from where this temple is. And when David wanted to build the temple, God said to him, heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool. God does not live in temples built with human hands. Tennyson put it this way, our little systems have their day, they have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they. There's a robustness there. There's a sense of the largesse of God. Or as C.S. Lewis said, I want God, not my idea of God. I want my neighbor, not my idea of my neighbor. I want myself, not my idea of myself. And following along this line, I tell my students, there are no last words. As soon as I say that, some of them fall into existential despair. They think I'm a relativist. I say, no, there are no last words. But that doesn't mean you can't have a sure word. And we need to mark the difference between the sure word in the last word. Truths we know can always be plumbed deeper. They can be applied wider. And they can be seen in coherent relations with other truths. We believe in absolutes, but we must be careful not to say we understand these things absolutely. We need to make sure that people who hear us understand that that's what we're saying. I was speaking one time last summer in a conference center in California, and I was talking about the benefits of postmodernism and the liabilities of postmodernism. It's helpful if it helps us get perspective on things. It's dangerous if it treats us to relativism. While I was talking about this, this one woman raised her hand. She says, we don't need any of that stuff. We don't need to think about it. We don't need to even exhaust our time there. I said, well, why is that? She said, well, the Bible's clear. We have the mind of Christ. I said, what do you mean by that? She says, we have the mind of Christ. We don't have to read these other books. I said, do you know where that passage is located? She said, no. I said, it's in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 16. Paul wrote it to a church where one group said, we're of Paul. Another said, we're of Apollos. Another said, we're of Peter. Another said, we're of Christ. If they had the mind of Christ, how come they didn't have any kind of unity in the midst of their unity in the midst of their diversity? I said, do you think when Paul wrote that, he meant that we have the mind of Christ as an accomplished fact? We somehow have achieved omniscience? We are rivals for the intelligence of God? Or do you think we have the mind of Christ like we have the Scriptures? Is a most valuable resource, and with that resource, the responsibility to seek to engage it and understand it in more deepening ways. Remember when I was in seminary, the dean of our seminary came to school this one day. Classes started at 8 o'clock. I was there at 7:45. He was a little bitty man, Charles Feinberg. He was about 5'1", 5'2". And he drove a little bitty compact car, and he pulled up at the seminary, and he was walking with a bounce to his step. And I said, Dr. Feinberg, you look particularly pleased with yourself today. He said, I am, Jerry. He said, I finished my Bible today, devotionally, for the 200th time. I said, wow. And then he corrected himself. I don't count the times I have read it in Greek and Hebrew. I mean the times I've read it devotionally. I said, well, sir, you've sailed your ship a little further on this sea than I've sailed mine. Are you still finding anything new in it? He said, on every page, on every page. It's a book that should constantly be taking our breath away. It's something that has depth to it. And we have the resource to try and plumb it as best we can. And our hearts being full of what we're discovering, rather than thinking we've got it all figured out. Lewis understood the difference, too, between truth and opinion. For him, truth was certain, but it wasn't complete. We could always plumb deeper, apply wider, as I've mentioned. Yet our understanding, it's developing. And Lewis said that our understanding is always going to be like the acquisition of rings to a tree. A tree doesn't give up the interior rings just because it adds more rings. But a tree that's growing will always be adding more rings. Opinion, he understood, was probable. And if it's probable, therefore it's subject to doubt. And if it's subject to doubt, reasonable people could differ on matters of opinion. Not only that, Lewis understood that there was a place of humility in the pursuit of truth and the understanding of reality. This is very critical. And this was, I think, one of the most attractive things in Lewis's apologetic style, is his humility. Now, that doesn't mean that he couldn't argue with confidence. That doesn't mean that he would be firm. You listen to his detractors who say, oh, he would bludgeon people. I've talked with people who argued with Lewis, and they said, oh, he would bludgeon people. And I said, well, give me an example of his bludgeoning. What they usually end up coming up with was he was far more prepared than they were, and they weren't ready to argue with him. But he never was dismissive. I'd say, well, do you remember in your debates with him, was he ever a person who engaged in dismissive ad hominems? Was he a person who would put you down? Was he a person who didn't respect you? No, none of that. None of that. Sometimes he was considered to be a bludgeoner, but always look behind the person who says that and see if what they mean by it is that he was confident and more prepared. But he treated people well. He wrote in one of his greatest pieces, he wrote a sermon called The Weight of Glory. There are no ordinary people. You've never met a mere mortal. Every person you meet will either one day be a horror, the likes of which you've only seen in a nightmare, or a person as you see them, when they will one day be, you'd be tempted to fall down and worship them as God. You've never met a mere mortal. He wanted to treat people with respect. This grew out of his humility. It was a vital feature of Lewis's apologetic method. And by the way, I think humility in Lewis is a synonym for honesty. It's a synonym for honesty. He says, in coming to understand anything, we must reject the facts as they are for us in favor of the facts as they are. And by the way, this is the best technology I can give you. I think I'm borderline dyslexic because I just realized recently that the no switch on my computer meant on. Okay, so this is the best I'm going to give you. I once met a really smart plumber. He graduated from university, went into a family plumbing business, had a liberal arts degree in literature, continued to read all of his life. As I watched his life, I thought, here's a good husband, here's a good father, here's a good man. One time when we were talking, he drew these three concentric circles on a napkin for me. And he said, these three concentric circles represent for me the acquisition of knowledge. If we continue to look in at the knowledge that we're gaining, we always run the risk of getting proud the larger our acquisitions. But the way to keep growing is to look out. And if you look out from the perimeter, the more you know, the greater the perimeter will reveal how much there is out there in greater proportion you know nothing about. It seems to me the acquisition of knowledge should lead to deeper humility. Lewis also said in this approach to humility that we have to awaken a sense of sin. We have to awaken a sense of sin in the person that we're talking with if we're going to get them to the gospel, the good news. But how do you do that? And Lewis says in his essay on Christian apologetics, begin with your own. Begin with your own struggle. Our tendency is to begin with theirs. Lewis says, begin with your own. Let me see if I can give you some examples in the Lewisian style. I've had privilege over the years to preach at several of the Oxford University chapels. Michael Chantry, who used to be the chaplain. Did you know Michael? He used to be a chaplain at Hartford, and then he was at Somerville also. For about 40 years, 45 years, he was a chaplain at Hartford. He asked me to come in and deliver an Evensong message one Sunday night and then to have dinner at High Table. High Table at Oxford, something else. The dining hall was about as big as this room. There were tables that ran the length of the hall, and that's where the students would sit. The faculty would sit at a table elevated about 3 steps up and perpendicular to the students' table. Honey-colored walls, honey-colored stone with wood paneling and these huge paintings of benefactors and famous graduates. You come dressed in academic gowns. They begin the meal with the Latin prayer, and you could cut the pretense with a knife. It's not so bad if you don't take yourself too seriously, but some people in that environment do. Chaplain introduced me as having just preached at the Evensong service, the Latin prayer. We sit down to eat. The woman sitting across from me teaches history there. She looks at me and she says, "Okay, Jerry, so why are you a Christian?" I thought she was asking because she wanted to know. Somebody told me after the dinner they thought she was asking because she wanted to make me the entertainment for that night's dinner. And I answered her as honestly as I could. I said, "You know, I'm a Christian because I've been devastated by the failures in my life. I've been devastated by the deficiencies in my life. I don't think I could make it in life and face life if I didn't know there was a thing called forgiveness. And not only that, I'm overwhelmed by the love of God who, knowing these deficiencies, still loved me and forgave me. And I found that compelling, and that's why I became a Christian." I think she was expecting some big philosophical argument. She looked at me and she said, "Well, I can appreciate that, but that's just not my issue." I said, "Well, I think I understand what you're saying. I didn't become a Christian until I was in my first year of college. And I didn't become perfect overnight. That took 2 or 3 weeks before that happened." The whole table of faculty busted up in laughter. I mean, gut-wrenching laughter. And I looked at the woman and I said, "Your laughter just betrayed you." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you and I just met, so you don't know the specifics in my life that made that statement nonsense. But you knew it was nonsense, which meant you had to get your information from some other source. Either your read of history or your read of your own heart tells you nobody has it together." She said, "You got me." I said, "Then knowing what you know about life and your own struggles, how do you make it each day?" She says, "I have faith in humanity." I said, "Well, help me, because I want anything that's going to help me. I want to ask you about your faith in humanity. Have you ever been wounded by another human being before?" She said, "Of course." I said, "Have you ever wounded another human being before?" She said, "I suppose so." She was softer on herself, you see. I said, "How does this faith in humanity work when we've been wounded by others and we've wounded others?" And the man who taught French sitting next to her said, "How does it work for Christians?" And we spent the rest of the time talking about the love of God and the grace of God. And how did we get there? It was sort of a Lewisian approach. Begin with your own struggle. And it will usually open up others to a place of honesty. Or at least if you believe that the environment was safe enough that you could talk about these things, maybe they'll be willing to unpackage beneath the surface of some sort of intellectual pretense. I'll give you another example. How many of you have talked with people before? They say, "I'm not interested in Christianity. Too many hypocrites in the church." How many of you have heard that one? Well, what if we took a Lewisian approach to it? I used to say to people, "Well, yeah, but can you think of a better place for the hypocrites? Yuck, yuck, yuck." And I would laugh. They didn't laugh because they had been burned by somebody. I read Lewis and I go to those situations now and I say, "You know what? It's really perceptive of you that you see hypocrites in the church. You know how I know you're right about this?" They say, "No, how?" I say, I'm one. I'm in the church. I believe in the high ideal of love, but I've had sharp words with people I love most in this world. I'm in the church, and I believe in justice, but I've been unfair in my treatment of others. I didn't set out to be unfair, but I know I have, and I realize it after the fact. No, I think you're very perceptive. There are hypocrites in the church. I know it because I'm one. With only one exception in hundreds of conversations, you know what the response has been? "When you put it like that, I'm one too." And now we're two pilgrims on the same road. And the very issue that was a barrier to their coming to faith opened the door to them to consider faith issues. I say, what have you found helps you? We're comparing notes now. They tell me about their struggles. I say, "You know what I found that helps me?" They say, "No, what?" They're very teachable at that moment. And I share with them the gospel. And I've seen many respond to faith when the hypocrisy issue was the barrier to faith. We can talk more about this. I've got a lot of examples, but that Lewisian approach of humility and beginning with our own struggle. Apologetics is not about winning arguments. It's about winning men and women to Christ. Lewis wrote, when the means become autonomous, that is separated from the ends to which they ought to serve, they become dangerous. He wrote in the Four Loves, 8 different places, when love becomes a god, it becomes a demon. I could substitute for love the word apologetics. When apologetics becomes a god, it becomes a demon. We can become obsessed with winning the arguments and bludgeon people with these. Also, apologetics and spiritual health are also to be connected. We should be secure in the love of Christ when we go to talk, so that if we hear accusations or we hear things that are demeaning to us as Christians, we need to listen to that and be secure in the love of Christ and see what the person's saying. I often think churches in America aren't doing much evangelism. George Barna said in 1986 that 87% of the churches in America were stagnant or in decline. Tom Rainer, the Southern Baptist statistician, said in, I think, 2002 that only 4% of the churches are evangelistic. And by evangelistic, he meant seeing one conversion for every 20 members. It's sad. Our churches, though, have all kinds of problems. Infighting and so on. My guess is if we were out evangelizing, hearing the criticisms of the churches were doing that, we would go back to the church and try and straighten up our messes so that we could authenticate the gospel of grace that we're preaching with good relationships in our interior lives, in our interior world. Apologetics and spiritual health should be connected. But here I take question with Lewis. If you've read the Mere Christianity, he says he thinks that pride is the great sin. Of course, he's echoing what Augustine said as well. But do you think that's true? Really? I know in American churches that I've seen a struggler will be marginalized. We'll use words like out of fellowship or carnal or backslidden. Though nobody would say it explicitly, implied in that is you've got to be perfect in this community. Nobody is perfect, so it breeds pretense. We make ourselves look better than we are. And pretense needs justification, so it moves into forms of Pharisaism and pride. I remember thinking one time, why were the Pharisees so proud? I thought, you know, I don't have to go very far to figure that out. What's going on inside of me when I become proud? If I put up a front to make myself look better to you than I am, what's driving that? Could it not be fear? That I'm afraid if you knew me as I really was, you might reject me? I think fear is antecedent to pride, and in some ways maybe fear is a greater sin than pride. But what casts out fear? Perfect love casts out fear. Imperfect love perpetuates fear. But perfect love casts out fear. I can go into the world as an apologist unafraid if I'm secure in the love of Christ, knowing that He loves me. So even if this person has a bad opinion of me, and even if because of that bad opinion, I have to look seriously at flaws in my life, get better, so in getting better, I will adorn the gospel that I'm proclaiming with a life that authenticates it, that's good. I know I've got problems. John Stott came to Wheaton College about 6 years ago. He spoke for 15 minutes and he fielded questions from the students. One student stood up and said, Dr. Stott, how do we reach a postmodernist for Jesus? And Stott gave a tight definition of postmodernism that showed that he had read much about it. Tight definition of deconstructionism. And then he said, the way to reach a postmodernist for Christ is by being an authentic person. As soon as he said that, I went into existential despair. Because I know I'm not an authentic person. I aspire to be, but I'm just too aware of too many places that are deficient in my life. I went shuffling out of the auditorium that morning in a funk. Finally, I started thinking, you know what? I don't think there's any authentic people. In fact, I think there's maybe only been one authentic person. And then I started thinking, maybe the question is a new question. What does an inauthentic person do to try to grow out of the inauthenticity? And I think it's by being honest about our inauthenticity. And we will be honest in the presence of the love of Christ, which makes us then own truths about ourselves which can validate the gospel, and we preach it, boy, I'll tell you, with a fresh fervor, because we know the love of Christ and the forgiveness of Christ fresh every day. Okay, now there's one other thing I need to say about Lewis, and that is his use of fiction and metaphor. And I'll try and say this quickly. How much time do we have left? Does anybody know? 20 minutes? Okay, because I want to give time for question and answer too, right? All right, I'll try and go as fast as I can. The word definition literally means of the finite. We define a thing by its limitation and its function. It has to be small enough to wrap words around it and be distinguished from another thing in order for us to define something. So how do you define God? If he's infinite, he breaks the category. So consequently, it seems to me, if we look at Jesus for an example, when he wants to talk about the kingdom of heaven, he says the kingdom of heaven is like. He uses simile and metaphor, figures of speech, parable, story, narrative. Lewis understood this as well. Matter of fact, he understands the use of metaphor. He says, in fact, there are different kinds of metaphor. There is the pupil's metaphor. The pupil's metaphor is when you don't understand an idea and you say, well, what if it's like this? And you cast a simile, or you come up with a metaphor, a figure of speech. What if it's like this? All development of thought requires some degree of imagination. Scientists, of course, know this because the scientist works with hypothesis. That's an imaginative endeavor. He says, what if it's like this? He casts a hypothesis and then sets out to try and prove the imaginative assumption. Well, theologians do this as well. Apologists do this. The pupil's metaphor. Then there's the master's metaphor. You're teaching the youth group at your church. You understand a concept well. You want to bring the students along. You as the teacher or the master, you come up with a metaphor and you share it with them so that you can bring them along. Master's metaphor. There's an interesting place, though, where Lewis uses this in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. He's reasoned his way from atheism through materialism and agnosticism, finally comes up to theism, finally comes to a place where he thinks it might be Christianity, but he postulates this as a pupil's metaphor, a person who doesn't know and says, I suppose it might be like this. He says, getting to know God personally must be a lot like Hamlet's trying to know Shakespeare. And he thinks it's impossible. How could Hamlet break out of the play to get to know Shakespeare? 2 years later, September 28, 1931, C.S. Lewis becomes a Christian. He says in his autobiography that he realized his Hamlet-Shakespeare metaphor was a good one. In fact, Hamlet could never break out of the play to get to know the author, but perhaps Shakespeare, the author, could have written himself into the play as Shakespeare, the character, and made the introduction between Hamlet, the character, and Shakespeare, the character, possible. He says, in fact, I think that's what happened in the Incarnation. Isn't that an elegant metaphor? But still, it could be teased out further, because every truth could be plumbed more deeply and applied more widely. And Lewis writes an essay called Transposition. There's always a difficulty. How do we communicate the greater so that the mind of the lesser can understand? Lewis says, my trying to understand God must be a lot like my dog trying to understand what I'm doing when I sit down to read a book. Or put another way, trying to understand God with my puny, finite mind must be a lot like trying to screw the sun into an electric light socket. And so he writes Transposition. Calvin said basically the same thing. Scriptures are, in a sense, divine baby talk. God distilling his omniscience down to us so that we could grasp some of it. Okay, in Transposition, we could take the Hamlet-Shakespeare model even further. Imagine with me that we're in Elsinore in Denmark. The king has been killed suddenly in the height of his power. Rather than the crown going to the crown prince Hamlet, it skipped over to Claudius, the uncle, the king's brother. Gertrude, the queen, hasn't even had a chance to grieve the loss of her husband. She's already married the uncle. There's a lot of fishy things going on. There are reports that the king's ghost has been seen at court, and that Hamlet's been seen talking to him, and Hamlet's been acting mighty strange, though some people say there's a method to his madness. And Ophelia, she's a basket case. And we're two people in the court, and we're walking through the courtyard, and we see this little man in Elizabethan tights, little earring and a little goatee. We say, who are you and how'd you get here? He says, well, my name's Shakespeare. I actually created the world you're living in, and I understand things have been a bit sketchy lately. kind of difficult for you. And I just showed up here to let you know that though things are going to still be difficult ahead, eventually everything's going to be smoothed out and all injustices will be righted. And how do we respond to him when he shows up? Right, right. You see the difficulty? That's the difficulty that the person that we're speaking to when we share Christ is struggling with. We need to understand where they're at. We need to recognize that our best metaphors can be improved. Our best arguments can be improved. We can go deeper with these things. We're honing our arguments, but we're also using imaginative endeavor, and all of these things are helpful to us. Lewis saw the value of fiction in doing apologetic work. Matter of fact, the first book he wrote after he was a Christian was The Pilgrim's Regress, an allegorical apology for reason, romance, and the Christian faith. He did his apologetic work. Some people think he had this debate at the Oxford Socratic Club with Elizabeth Anscombe, and after that he was devastated in his apologetics, and he ended up turning to fiction only, and that fiction was that. That's not true. He didn't write any more apologetic books to be true after that debate, but I wouldn't say it was in causal relationship to that debate, because he wrote 61 essays on Christian apologetics. 31 of them he wrote before the debate. 30 he wrote after the debate. Not only that, the essay on Christian apologetics, where he talks about humility and being mindful of our own sin and our own struggle as we do apologetic work, he wrote that within months after that debate. Very interesting to me. Lewis used fiction not as a sign of his inability to compete intellectually in the academic arena doing his apologetic work. He used fiction because he saw it was valuable for saying certain things. He wrote in a preface to Paradise Lost, "We always have to remember that the man who writes a love sonnet not only loves the woman, but also loves the sonnet. And sometimes he says, fiction says best what we want to say." And I think that's helpful for us. Let me just end with this one prayer of Lewis's. It's the Apologist's Evening Prayer. And after he had successfully defended some arguments, he then went on to go home and write this prayer about the fact that sometimes he could successfully defend an argument and he had to fight pride in his heart. And he prays that. He confesses it to God. And then at the end of the prayer that he wrote, he said, "Thoughts are but coins. Let me not trust instead of thee their thin-worn image of thy head. From all my thoughts, even from my thoughts of thee, O thou fair silence, fall and set me free." Okay, any comments or questions?
You made the statement earlier that Lewis said on a number of occasions that all worldviews will be discarded.
I said all worldviews will be discarded, and I was using that from Lewis. What was the idea? Reality is iconoclastic.
Okay.
So it was my application of reality as iconoclastic.
Okay. I'll ask you to get inside the mind of Lewis, since you probably can do that better than the rest of us.
I don't know if I can.
But it's very typical for Christians or evangelicals nowadays to talk about a biblical worldview as some kind of fixed or objective worldview. And of course, that seems to lie in tension with the idea of all worldviews will be discarded. What do you imagine Lewis would say to the idea of a, quote, biblical worldview that has some kind of fixed objective anchor if all worldviews will be discarded?
Well, there may be an objective worldview in the scriptures, and I should try to get to that as best I can. But I don't think that I'm going to get there. I don't think any of my theology, the whole history of Christian thought has shown us modification all the way along, whether it be in the form of councils or whatnot. So I don't think that I'm going to say, well, finally at my day, we've arrived. You see, that doesn't mean that we don't hold truth, but we just haven't plumbed it all the way yet or seen all of its applications. Even the Bible was written in an agrarian society, right? Does it have application for the industrial age or the technological age or whatever age comes after that? I believe it does. We haven't even begun to imagine its applications. So I think that oftentimes, and this is where the danger comes, there's something in the scriptures. I want to understand it. Sometimes I think I do fully understand it, or project myself as if I fully understand it. And at that place, I have inauthenticated my message. But why can't I talk about it in a way of Well, let me give you another example. Heaven. I don't think heaven's going to be static. I think it's going to be dynamic. It says we'll be like Christ when we see him. I don't think it means we'll be like Christ in his deity. I think it means we'll be like Christ in his perfected humanity. Sin will be purged from us. We will be finitely perfect before the infinitely perfect God. So if I know 0 to 100 bits of information about God, unclouded, how much more is there still to know about the infinite God? An infinite amount, right? If I know 0 to 1,000 bits, how much more is there still to know? An infinite amount. If I know 0 to 1,000,000, I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of it. And all of heaven, I think every moment we're going to say. Well, I have this long, engaged theological debate with a friend of mine. He thinks the first words we say when we get to heaven, first word will be, oh. Oh. So that's why those bad things happened back there. Oh, this or that. I think he's wrong. I think it's going to be, wow. Wow, I didn't know that about him. Wow, I didn't know that either. Wow, I think we're going to be perpetually mind-blown on the glory of God. And I think we need to communicate that even now while we're doing apologetics. This is something dynamic and exciting. This isn't something that we've got in a box. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Joe, just very briefly before I give the mic to Chris. Obviously, we do continue to enlarge our view about God, but what are the rules for that enlargement? What are the epistemological rules?
Well,
or can we just enlarge in any direction we want?
Well, I think if we follow Lewis's metaphor of the tree and rings, that the rules of enlargement is that the truth that we're enlarging, it's like a body with a skeletal structure or a tree with rings. The tree doesn't have to give up the interior rings because it's adding new rings. But the rules for the enlarging of a tree, gaining girth in its trunk, is it enlarges around that which is already there that has been proven over time to be true and valid. Is that helpful? Sorry. There you go.
I guess I just wanted to maybe understand correctly, but it's also still being a tree, not being a frog.
That's exactly right.
And maybe that's what you were referring to in the rules of enlargement. That it's still a tree. It's still a tree, but it's just...
Exactly. That we can have a sure word, but we don't have a last word. We're not relativists. Okay? But also, we're not tyrants. We're not tyrants. Yes?
My name is Chris, Chris Townsend. My question is, you were a pastor for 23 years. Mm. To what extent and in what ways did your experience as a pastor help you now in what you would call your apologetic ministry? And for those of us who here who aren't or will never be pastors, is there something for us to learn or ways that we could address what we might miss?
I don't know exactly how to answer that because I found over the years I had to repent of some things I did as a pastor. Have you ever heard a preacher get up before and say, I'm not telling you this, this is the word of God? Have you ever heard that? I think I maybe said that a couple times. And I don't know that it was the word of God. I think it was my take on the word of God. So I think maybe there's some good things that happen in pastoral ministry and some bad things. And probably as apologists, there's some good things that happen and some bad things. I think we each have to evaluate those things for ourselves. I'm ashamed of some things I've done in the past. I don't think you can grow without some degree of regret. I know things today that I didn't know 10 years ago, and I was making decisions 10 years ago. And if I would have known what I knew today, I would have made different decisions. And so the increase of knowledge creates in me an evaluative look at the past that causes me some degree of sorrow. And that's not always bad. I can go back and make some of those things right. But why grow if I'm just going to have regrets? So I don't think I can grow without grace. And understanding that God is there to meet me, to forgive me, to love me, to pick me up and help me get going on. I don't want to use the love of God as an excuse for mediocrity. I want to make progress. That also means I'm making decisions today. Who knows what it is that I've said to you today that when I read more over the next 10 years, I'm going to say, why did I say that at the forum? You know, I think that we're doing the best we can. God help us. God help us all. Yes, sir.
Jerry, Ian Cooper. Christians often talk in relation to apologetics about the need, as we've been discussing today, to use the imagination, to use literary talent, to make films, to write really good pop songs, and because they see the example of Lewis, in a sense, and other writers. But only Lewis has got his kind of talent, his kind of quality. And so much of what one sees in the Christian world, which imitates what he's trying to do, is really rather poor. So how do we encourage the Christian community to generate people of real talent, who in a sense are story writers, filmmakers, music makers, who see their calling, in a sense, to bear witness to God, but also don't just turn it into a kind of utilitarian...
Sure.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure.
That's my question.
And there are many who use their talent in a utilitarian way.
Yeah.
I don't know. For sure, Lewis had gifts, and my guess is everybody has gifts. God gives gifts to men, Christian and non, I think, and then he gives spiritual gifts to Christians. So maybe I can help somebody discover, they may think they're a great singer, and, you know, maybe I have to come and say, actually, you're not, you know, or maybe come with a few people and say you're not. But you know what? God has wired you in a way that you have gifts, and help them find those gifts and then help them hone them. Lewis had gifts, but also Lewis held those gifts up to scrutiny so that he honed them. And he honed them, even his intellectual gifts, even his writing gifts. He didn't just write his books in isolation. He wrote them and read them to the Inklings. He had critics like Tolkien, Charles Williams, Hugo Dyson, Neville Coghill. He had these great minds critiquing his work as he wrote it. And there was a honing. As a matter of fact, maybe that's even a call to develop our gifts in community. And so we can have honest feedback and engage and have people help shape us and direct us to those places where we would be most useful for kingdom purposes. But I think you're right. I don't think that Lewis was in any way manipulative or utilitarian, even in his writing the Narnian Chronicles. He was writing as a Christian and these things came out. But I don't think he had, I think he had as an end, like most rhetoricians would have, the desire to delight. And that's what he was doing. Is that fair? I don't know how else to go exactly.
Well, I guess my question is, can you legitimize for people the desire to delight? Because if you get that right first, then you can actually also do something. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's important to, in other words, take your art seriously as well as your calling, your Christian calling.
I think that's true. Tomorrow I'm going to talk in the art forum, and I'm going to talk about Lewis's idea of beauty, and I want to address those issues then. But I think that is the key, is find delight. And that's the idea of Lewis getting shoulder to shoulder with the person and describing reality. If God could be found in reality itself, then that kind of teaching, I would suggest to you, is a doxological approach to teaching. It's full of wonder and awe. And I'll talk about that in the art forum tomorrow.